Today's reading is from Isaiah. Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not grow faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the faint and strengthens the powerless. Even youths will faint and be weary, and the young will fall exhausted. But those who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God.
Well, as you can see from the sermon title, The Importance of Pace, today we're going to be talking about pace and the pace at which we live our lives. So, just an opening question. If you were to rate your life on how busy you are from 1 to 10, what number would you assign yourself? Like if you were rating your busy, you know, how busy you are, how stressed you are, what would you say? We went out on the street and asked some people in downtown Indy what they would give to that answer, and we'll check out their responses.
Hey, St. Luke's, we are talking about Sabbath this weekend. We're talking about pace of life, stress, and how to find rest in our lives. What, on a scale of 1 to busy, how busy would you say your life is?
I say busy.
Very busy?
Mm-hmm.
Busy. It's 10, a million, whatever.
It's busier than busy.
You have no idea.
1 to 10, 10 being stressed, mine stays at a 20.
What do you do to take the edge off of your stress in life?
You know, a lot of times I would read, I put in my good music, like what I'm listening to now, Barry White.
Relax, listen to music, and have a cocktail.
I really just don't worry about what I can't control. It took me a long time to learn that, but if I can't control it, I don't worry about it.
We're from St. Luke's.
Oh, right. Okay. So what are you giving up for Lent?
Because you don't really reflect this persona of stress.
I try not to.
How do you do that?
Just step back from it all and just try to find something that I like to do. So like go for a walk, go for a hike.
Yeah, I guess try to rely on certain hobbies. I fish, I golf.
Talk things out when things are stressful.
We're interviewing people for our church. Would you have a second?
People are stressed. They don't have time for an interview.
People need some Sabbath up in this place.
So you've heard it said, accept the things you cannot change. Run for the mall. The massage chair, baby. It's working for me. Oh. Would you have a second for an interview?
My cat is kind of my go-to stress-free zone. He thinks he's a dog sometimes, but it's fine.
So it's a dog cat, it all works.
I'll say don't sweat small stuff. It's all small stuff.
The Optimist Club, this will lower your stress.
Absolutely, yes. Being surrounded by positive people.
I think for me, faith is probably something that's super important to help me keep grounded. Plus, I have 3 golden retrievers and they are huge stress relievers.
I realized that like I play games on my phone all the time and that was using up a lot of my time that I could have been doing other things. Meditate on the scriptures for myself is a huge part of the time that I spend.
So there you have it, St. Luke's. At some point, it seems that stress is coming for us all. The important thing to remember is how to pace ourselves.
The important thing to remember is how we pace ourselves. In his book, Great by Choice, Jim Collins gives a wonderful story, example of the importance of pace. He tells the story of 2 South Pole expeditions. It took place in 1911. 2 countries, Britain and Norway that were racing to be the very first country to plant their flag at the South Pole. And I'll go ahead and tell you, much like it was with the Winter Olympics, the Norwegians carry the day. But it's a great example of pace. There were leaders of each expedition. The Norwegian leader was a man named Amundsen, and you can see his picture there. And the British leader was a man named Robert Scott. I didn't say Amundsen's first name because, honestly, I know I won't pronounce it correctly. It's Norwegian. So it had a lot of extra vowels in there. But these two men were the leaders of their expedition. Now, Amundsen was known for his fanatic discipline. I mean, he was fastidious, detailed to the nth degree of all of his planning, everything buttoned down, locked down, every step of the journey planned before they left. Scott was also a very good planner, but he was known more as a risk taker, one who was more prone to embrace technology. For instance, instead of using traditional dogs and sleds, he had like a snowplow type machine that was going to carry, you know, all of their equipment with them. And so he was more of a risk taker. Now, and this played out in the paces they each chose to keep. Amundsen had a strict rule, 15 miles, no more during the day. And so they would march for 15 miles, and if it was a beautiful day, and say they arrived, you know, at the 15-mile mark, and it was early afternoon, and they still, you know, the light's out, they could have gone further. No, he stopped them, because 15 miles was as far as they went. But even on the really terrible days, where the snow and the wind was bitter, they still went out 15 miles, or as close as they could, to reach that mark every day, 15 miles. Whereas Scott was more of a, let's just go with the flow as far as what the weather allows us to do. On great days, they would march 20, 25 miles. On bad days, they would just hunker down in the tents and wait for the weather to pass. You can kind of see where this is going, right? It's a modern-day story of the tortoise and the hare. By the time Scott's team arrived at the South Pole, they found that Amundsen's team had planted their flag 34 days prior. And then on the return journey, because they had to get all the way back, disaster struck. The equipment that he had kind of bet the farm on broke down, and then they ran out of supplies, and all of Scott's team ended up starving in the cold, never made it home. It's a wonderful story for church, just to encourage you. But Jim Collins tells the story to say this is the importance of pace. He says smart companies do, and smart leaders do what Amundsen did. They set a goal, a sustainable pace, and then they go out each and every day, and they complete their 20-mile march. It's interesting, Jim Collins didn't think 15 was ambitious enough. He had to amp it up to 20-mile march. That's the phrase he coined. But every day, if you just go so far and stop, and you can sustain that, you will beat the competition, he says. But what I think Collins is talking about is not just applicable to business. I think it's applicable to our lives as well. There is a pace at which we can thrive, a pace which we can sustain with energy and vigor. And then there's another pace that will wear us out, that will burn us out and leave us completely empty. And the question I ask you is, what pace are you living at? It's kind of ironic for me to be preaching about this because lately, Jamelyn and I, we feel like we've been living at kind of a breakneck pace, so to speak. Part of the trouble is that we've started decluttering our home because we know we're going to have to move them. And anyone who knows what decluttering a home is like, it is an endless amount of work. Because this is not a picture of our home, by the way. Jamelyn would have killed me if I put our home up on the screen. But our realtor came with caution tape, you know, like roped off certain parts of the house that were just. But decluttering is endless work. Because just when you think you're done, there's always another pile to go through or to box up or another drawer to pull out. And you think, you know, just when you think you're done, then you remember, oh, that cabinet, I didn't go through that. And so I tend to take an Energizer Bunny kind of approach, you know, maybe like Amundsen. I just do a little bit at a time. I set a pace, and I just keep going. And even when I'm tired, I do that one more thing. Or even when I'm tired, I take that other thing out to the garage. Or even when I'm tired, I just keep boxing up. And I keep doing that. And the problem is, for me, is that I'm discovering there's always one more thing. And after that, one more thing. And after that, one more thing. So I go to bed at night running down the checklist of all the things that are still needing to be done. And I'm going to get up in the morning and do those. But then there's a whole other list that replaces that list. And this isn't just true when you're decluttering your home. It's also true anywhere, anytime. There's always one more thing. One more email to send, one more project to do, one more person to call, one more relationship to maintain. There's always one more thing. I was talking to Rob about this, you know, this challenge of always one more thing. How do we know when to stop? How do we know when we've gone far enough? How do we know when we've reached our 15 miles? And he said, you know, it's kind of like golden retrievers or any kind of retriever breed. Retrievers are bred to chase balls. There's something in their DNA and their genetics that makes them chase the ball. As long as you throw the ball, the retriever will go after it. Even if they're exhausted, even to the point of death, they will keep on chasing. And when he told me that, I said, well, my dogs are not retrievers. Because when they get tired, they stop and they look at me like, you go get it. You know, but the way he said it, as long as there's a ball to chase, as long as there's one more thing. I mean, are we much different, you and I? I think sometimes that's why we like this Isaiah passage. Because it kind of almost implies you don't have to stop, right? You can soar on wings like eagles. You can run and not grow weary. You can walk and not faint. You can just keep going and going and going and going. But it's important to remember where this passage comes from and what it's a response to. See, we read verses 28 to 31, but verse 27 is actually the starting point of this little passage. In verse 27, we find Israel complaining about how tired and weary they are. The prophet says, "Why do you say, O Jacob, and complain, O Israel, saying, 'My way is hidden from the Lord, my cause is disregarded from my God'?" You think you're tired or weary? Try walking in the shoes of Israel. At this point in history, when the prophet is addressing them, they have lived in captivity in Babylon for more than 30 years, more than a generation, lived in captivity. And who knows what physical task they've been given, because they're expendable labor. The Babylonians don't care about them. So I'm sure that it was whatever back-breaking task needed to be done, that's what they were set to. But it wasn't just physical exhaustion, it's a spiritual exhaustion. A whole generation has passed, and nothing has changed. I mean, there's no hope on the horizon. They felt abandoned by God, forgotten, disregarded is the word that Isaiah uses, tossed aside. I was talking to a lady last week. You know, we gave out these carabiners to remember our faith expedition and clip on somewhere just as a way of remembering to stay connected to God. And one lady came up to me and she said, you know, these carabiners, they're amazing. And she told me a story about when she was younger and went rappelling and how, you know, your whole weight is just hanging on this one tiny carabiner. And she said, you know, once we went down into Louisville and we're doing some caving and spelunking and we would rappel down 80 feet into a pit to the point where looking up, you know, the light where we came in, the hole where we came was just this tiny pinprick up above us, you know, this tiny little dot of light. And as she was describing that, as I did the research for this text, I thought maybe that's what Israel felt like. Way down in a pit. Just a little bit of light way up above them, and they're just holding on, hanging on for dear life. Have you ever been there? That's the weariness that they felt. What's interesting is how God responds to their complaint. A lot of times when you see complaining in the Bible, God kind of, you know, beats it down, smack, you know, like a backhand, you know, like, but not this time. God instead responds with grace and encouragement. He says, "Don't you know? Haven't you heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. And he does not grow tired or weary. His understanding no one can fathom. Instead, he gives strength to the weary. He increases the power of the weak." The New Interpreter's Bible commentary put it this way. He said, you know, Israel's weariness and exhaustion, it's not a barrier to experiencing God's grace, but it's actually the entry point. It's the portal through which they come to understand God's power. Weariness and exhaustion is not a stumbling block. It's only an overconfidence in your own strength that keeps you from experiencing grace. I mean, this is the way in which they come to know who God is, that when their strength is gone, then they come to know one who never grows tired, one who never grows weary. So really what I'm talking about when I talk about keeping Sabbath, it's not just about keeping pace, like taking a day off to get refreshed, although that's important. It's really about making space to connect with God, connect with one who doesn't grow tired or weary, connect with one who replenishes our strength and our courage and our hope. It's about prioritizing that connection, saying it's more important to pray, to worship, to abide in Christ than to do that one more thing that's competing for attention. When we keep Sabbath, we declare who has ultimate claim on our lives. A number of years ago, I had the opportunity to hear Doug Fields, who is a pioneer in youth ministry, was speaking to a conference with thousands of ministers present, and he described how early in his ministry, you know, when he's just starting out and trying to build something, how he was always chasing that one more thing, you know, whether it was a student that he wanted to bring into the youth group, or whether it was an event he had to go to, or speaking engagement, or any, and he was always doing that one more thing to the point where ministry had no boundaries in his life. I mean, ministry was everything, 24/7. That was all he did, thought, breathed. And then he said, you know, eventually I got married and started having kids and realized I had to start putting boundaries around this work. I wasn't good at it. He says, but I started safeguarding my day off, and I got religious, fastidious about taking my day off. And he says, it wasn't always easy because you don't get rewarded for taking the day off. And he had a supervisor at one point in particular who gave him a real hard time. He says, day off, day off. You're always talking about your day off. And then this guy said, I don't take a day off. And you know why? Because the devil doesn't take a day off. And I love Doug's response. He said, you know, you're right, but I'll tell you something. The devil is not my model. In fact, maybe that's why the way he is. If he took a day off, maybe he wouldn't be such a mean guy, right? I always love that response. For me, it reminds me that if I can't take a day off, I'm not worshiping the real God. I'm worshiping a false God. Because the real God, Yahweh, invites me to rest, to be refreshed, to be renewed in his strength. It's the false God of my own self-importance, or my control, or perfection, or needing to please everyone, or needing to achieve. It's the false God of one more thing that leaves us exhausted. It is a relentless master, and we have to say no. When I was beginning a ministry and struggling with this myself, a friend gave me a prayer, an old prayer from the Book of Common Prayer. It was called the Prayer of Compline. Compline is evening, the end of day, an old Latin word. And I would put this prayer on my desk, and I'd pray it every day. When that clock hit 6 o'clock and I knew I needed to be heading home, I'd read the prayer. And the prayer went something like, Dear God, thank you for this day. And I ask for your blessing on the good I've tried to do. The things I've tried to do, you know, may they land close to their mark. And the things that I've messed up on, forgiving. But the part that the words I clung to, and I ask God for your grace for those things I've left undone. Help me to entrust them into your care and know that they'll wait for me until I can return. In other words, God, I've done my 15 miles today. I pray it's enough. And help me now to enter into rest so that tomorrow I can do another 15 miles by your grace. Pace. The interesting thing about this passage is with regards to pace is what happens at the end. When you get to the promise of what God does when he renews our strength, it's interesting how Isaiah puts it. He says, those who wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall soar on wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. The order of the verbs is interesting, isn't it? Soar, then run, then walk. It's like they're gearing down, right? Why are they gearing down? We tend to think in the opposite. You know, first we crawl, then we walk, then we run. Like, we should be going at ever-increasing speeds and activity. You know, like, why are they gearing down? Rob and I were talking about this, and he said he had a friend who preached a sermon noting the oddity of these words, and afterwards a woman in his congregation came up to him and said, Pastor, I don't think they're odd at all. These words make sense, because this is how it was in my Christian life. When I first became a Christian, I was soaring. I mean, I was so full of zeal and passion. I mean, I just took off. The problem was is that I was way up over everyone else and looking down upon them, wondering why they weren't living with the same zeal and intensity that I was. But God was gracious, and he helped me to come down off my high horse. And then I learned to run. And I served, and I did everything. I was so involved in my church, and I did lots of things, because the way I measured my faith was by how much I got done, and I ran, and I ran, and I ran. But then God was gracious, and now he's teaching me to walk. He's teaching me it's not so much about what I do, but what about God does in me, and through me, and around me. And isn't this what the prophet Micah told us that God requires? To do justice, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. And I began thinking, as you know, when Rob told me that story, it made me think about the youth we see on TV now from Stoneman Douglas High School. I mean, if you've watched these kids on the news, I mean, they are soaring, right? I mean, they are so full of energy and passion. It's contagious, it's inspiring, it's compelling to see these students. I mean, even if you don't necessarily agree with the stance they're taking, it's heartening in some ways to see our kids taking a stand, getting involved. But the thing that's been concerning to me is I've been wondering, you know, what happens when they hit a strong headwind? Because they're soaring high, right? What happens when they start hitting resistance, which they're already hitting resistance, aren't they? What happens when after a few weeks and gridlock is still going on and they haven't made any change, what happens to that energy and zeal? I've been worried. Is it just going to turn into disappointment? Is that disappointment going to fuel greater disengagement? Because Isaiah even says it. He says, even youths grow weary and young men stumble and fall. And I know there are people who are just waiting for their energy to burn itself out. Don't get me wrong, soaring is important. Soaring is what gets us out of the gate. It gets us moving. But over the long haul, what is required is not soaring. What is required is the ability to walk 15 miles again and again and again and again. It's what Eugene Peterson calls a long obedience in the same direction. If you're trying to change something, or even if you're just trying to live out your faith, what is required is a long walk. And to keep that walk going in the face of resistance, in the face of heartache, when you fail and fall flat on your face, and to keep stand up and keep on going, that requires Sabbath. It requires getting connected to someone who doesn't stumble, who doesn't get tired, who doesn't get weary, and who renews your strength, your hope, your courage to keep on going. William Wilberforce led the fight against slavery in the British Empire for, I don't know, 40 plus years. He entered into Parliament, was elected to Parliament in 1784. In 1785, he joined the Methodist movement, became a committed Christian. In 1787, that's when he took up first the cause of anti-slavery, and specifically it was the slave trade that he took up the cause of. 1787, it wasn't until 1807, 20 years later, that he was successful in moving through Parliament the British Slave Trade Act, which abolished slave trading everywhere in the British Empire. 20 years, that's a long walk. But as soon as he finished that walk, he said, that's not enough. We've ended the slave trade, now we need to end the practice of slavery. And so for another 20 years he fought, until in 1826 he retired from the Parliament because his health just couldn't keep him going anymore. It took another 7 years beyond that, 1833, before Britain passed the Slavery Abolition Act, which outlawed the practice of slavery in the entire British Empire. William Wilberforce heard the news, and he died 3 days later, his life works complete. 46 years. That's a long walk. If you want to walk that long, you need a God who is going to sustain you. And so I take you all the way back to 1791, 4 years into his battle, which turned out to be a 40-year battle, a man named John Wesley, who was the founder of the Methodist movement, wanted to write to William Wilberforce to encourage him. John Wesley himself wrote this letter 4 days before he died, but he wanted to encourage him in the good fight, and so here's what he wrote. He said, "Unless the divine power has raised you up, I see not how you can go through with your glorious enterprise in opposing that villainy which is a scandal of religion in England and of human nature. Unless God has raised you up for this very thing, you will be worn out by the opposition of men and devils. But if God be for you, who can be against you? Are all of them together stronger than God? So be not weary in well-doing. Go on in the name of God and in the power of his might, till even American slavery, the vilest that ever saw the sun, shall vanish away before it. So may he who has guided you from your youth up, may he continue to strengthen you in this and all things. That is the prayer of your affectionate servant, John Wesley." It's a long climb. It's a long climb. And I sincerely hope at the end of my life to be able to say with the Apostle Paul, "I have fought the good fight, I've run the race, I've kept the faith." Don't you want that? But for us to be able to do that with integrity, for us to be the people God calls us to be and do the works that he's pre-planned for us to do, we have to make space. We have to live at a pace that gives God space to call, to renew, to encourage, to strengthen us to walk in his footsteps. That's what Sabbath is about.